we do like to record these conversations, because what we do is we put them on our website, and we also have post-session notes that we send to everyone that describes what we were talking about. So all the people that may not have been able to attend this particular session or come in late or whatever can see what we did. So we'd like to start off with GLOW, giving us an update. And we've got Amber Perry from the regional office on, and she might be able to also give us some insight on what was happening. GLOW, do you want to give us the news from Washington?
Well, the new grantees were announced on June 21st. There were 15 new awards. I don't know much more than that, I guess. A lot of them, some of them were people or projects that had been funded before, and there were some new ones in there too, which was good to see. Amber, do you want to add anything to that?
We're going to be talking about in today's session about those awards, and we'll probably be asking some questions. So we'll hold that thought just for a second. Now, do you want to also, and we've got people online who may be interested in attending the Alexandria conference this year. Do you want to give us an update on what's happening with the annual grantee meeting, GLOW?
The annual grantee meeting is confirmed for October 1st and 2nd. We will be having the optional safety training in the afternoon of the first day. And then the grantee meeting itself starts at 6 p.m. on that Monday and goes from 8 until 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday. It's open to all EPA-funded grantees, whether they're currently working on EPA dollars or not. And all of the new grantees, all the new awards, will be invited also.
So that we try to get all the alumni. We try to get all of the current grantees. And then, of course, we're going to be announcing in the next round of PLC meetings that people who regularly attend the PLCs will also have an opportunity to attend. These would be communities that have been trying to get something together and really are making a hard effort to do it, but just can't quite get it together. So we thought that if they could immerse in a group of people who have been doing it for many years and some who have been in it and are out of it, we have people that are there who are not funded and people who are in between funding. It gives them a chance to get an idea and also do some networking and contacts of people that they may get in touch with. So another thing that GLOW has been working on, she's been working on two other projects that may have interest be of interest not only to the grantees but those interested in starting programs. One is a scan of all the graduates coming out of the programs, and the other one is our website. GLOW, do you want to elaborate a little bit on each of those?
Okay. Yeah, Mike is right. I did do a scan of all the grantees who wanted to answer on when they were going to be having their graduations, how many people they were going to be graduating, that type of thing. And I put that out on our listserv that goes out to employers, and then I also put it out on our Brumfield's Toolbox website, which hopefully will help the grantees place their students. If it gets continually updated, just whenever anyone has any updates to give me, they just send it, and it's very easy to update since it's electronic. The other thing that Mike was mentioning is our Brumfield's Toolbox, and yes, we are in the process of redoing that to make it a much more user-friendly format. We have a new web designer here in my department, and he's done an excellent job. It is not done yet, but it is close to being done, and I've been told that it will be definitely live before the grantee meeting in October. But right now, we are in the process of collecting photos and what other kind of information the grantees want to send. And we're going to have like a slideshow on the home page of all these different photos from the grantees so that they can share what they've been doing. They can put up pictures of their graduations, anything they want. And we have gotten a lot of response on that. So I'm really anxious to see the end product of that. It's going to be very, very cool.
Well, what we want to do at the website, and we put PLC recordings on there, and we also want to keep that as a resource for those who want to start job training programs. And the purpose of what we're doing today is partially to get communities, those people that may have an interest or have had a grant or are interested in job training, to see if they want to test the waters. And one of the things we encourage is trying to put questions up on the website. If someone's having difficulty with some issue, a job training issue or an organizational issue, they can put those questions up, and we can try to get response from other grantees to those questions. So that, the whole purpose being those who have grants, to try to make them a little bit better, and those who are interested in starting programs or getting grants, we want to help them. And there are some people out there that really aren't interested in the federal money. And we've got people like New Jersey Youth Corps who started with us, and they're alumni and have been to every meeting. And, of course, many people think they're just regular grantees, but they really don't need our funding anymore, ours meaning the EPA funding, and they're striking out on their own. As a segue into what we're going to talk about today in terms of these grants being awarded, I talked to two other grantees that were, it was interesting, OAI out of Chicago, and JFY, Paula Paris out of Boston. These are both outstanding grantees who have been on the program for many years. They've been funded. They would sit out for a while and come back, and they've also been to the grantee meetings. And neither of them applied this year. They decided to sit out this year. So, and I did ask them why, and they felt that it was a difficult RFP to respond to at this point. So they're going to sit out a year and see how things go. They're also still very involved in these job training programs. They're performing, but without federal funding. So that's originally the idea of this program, is to get your programs going and to keep it going, and then perhaps occasionally you may reapply and get additional funds to expand your program, but you can go and sustain yourself even though you may not get funded for a year. And that's one of the things of one of the goals of the program. But let's talk a little bit about one of the things we're going to do is talk about can we learn anything from the 15 grantees that were awarded this go-around. And we kind of went through all of the grantees and their fact sheets and those we are familiar with, and some of the ones that have been on the PLC. Actually, five of the 15 are PLC members who came to the PLC and have sat in on our discussions on and off. And, of course, we've got six of them who have been coming to the Alexandria meetings through the years. So people who come to the Alexandria meetings are pretty well up on one of these breakout sessions, what different people are doing around the communities. The PLC members may not be as familiar with this, and we were happy to see them be successful. We had Nye County, and Hunter's Point was a really exciting one, because when Hunter's Point came to the PLC, they were very concerned. It's truly a community organization. They were very concerned about the politics of the area. And, of course, Ars Shanks, Cypress Mandela Training Center, who has also got, he also got a grant. He's gotten grants for many years. He's one of the original grantees. Art has such an outstanding program, but he's fairly close. They're he's across the bay. He's up in Oakland, and of course they're down at Hunters Point. But there was some concern: is, you know, do we have two grantees too close together? That's always been a concern. But in this case, Hunters Point was funded at $200,000. We had a surprising number of re-ups, which is interesting. Some early on, there were always, when the program was first organized, the question even arose, should a program be re-upped? And, of course, I think as the program developed, I think we came to realize that outstanding programs need this added boost, particularly when they're doing so well. And people like Art Shanks, we've got just a number of the Limitless Vistas. We've got the Cypress Mandela we talked about. We've got LA Conservation Corps. We've got Durham, which was an interesting program in North Star. Durham, which is in my backyard, had a program that was interesting because prior to this year, they were very focused on air programs, and the RFP, of course, this year came out, and it's focused not on air programs. In fact, it doesn't include air programs. It includes water, wastewater, and the ones that were in the RFP, the solid waste, of course, and chemical awareness, and they altered their grant, and they're providing the wastewater treatment, and they're addressing more of the programs that were interested, that the EPA was interested in them delivering. But if we try to look at some commonalities, I thought, well, it might be interesting to see if EPA had any commonalities in reviewing these. And it's interesting as you look at the programs, they are very diverse. And probably the one thing I can say in looking at all of these different grant proposals is that they aren't really common. The thing that you could say that is common are things that you would expect. They all do address the training required, of course, by the grant, and you would expect that. They all provide quite a few certifications. The certifications that they are giving their grantees range anywhere from 4 up to as many as 10. I believe Milwaukee is providing 10 certifications with a very rigorous program. It's 105 hours. I believe that North Star has an extremely rigorous program. They're providing 8 certifications with 226 hours of training. So they have an extremely rigorous program. They all provide certs. They are all working with community groups and have very strong partnerships. Those partnerships, though, differ between the grantees. So from our point of view, it seemed as if it wasn't so much who your partners were, but that those partners were relevant in the community that you were in. And they all had very strong partners, though. And that was one common trait of all of them. They all, of course, tracked. Some went as far as 18 months to 2 years. They all, of course, tracked minimum 1 year. But they stayed with their students as much as the 2 years. It's interesting that the Oregon Tradeswomen, who are an outstanding grantee out in Portland, Oregon, they work with minority and unwed minority women and underserved populations, women populations, they're tracking for 2 years. And the interesting thing about Oregon Tradeswomen is they're talking about training about 30 women with about 23 placements. So they're not a large program, but they're only providing 68 hours of instruction. But what they're doing is they're nurturing the people in their community. So here in Oregon Tradeswoman, you have a grantee who is very nurturing and a very narrow targeted group of women in the Portland area within a certain demographic. They're not giving them tons of certifications. They're not giving them, they're not talking about huge numbers, but it appears as if they're working very closely with them, and they're going to make sure they all get jobs. So that would be one extreme, where you have this very small nurturing program. And then you've got the other programs that go completely to the other extreme. You've got Iowa says they're going to train 100 people. That's Western Iowa. And we're talking about 100 people in Western Iowa, which is going to be a challenge. We're talking about placing 80. They all have the number of people that are coming into the program, and then they have the placement that they expect to place. Of course, that number is hard to predict. There's a minimum requirement. I don't think that that's a relevant number. When you look at people like Art Shanks, who he traditionally trains about 100 people, he said he was going to train 80 and place 60. Well, Art usually trains 80 to 100 and places 80 to 100. So he has an extremely good track record, and he keeps placing them until they're placed. So you've got that type of program. You see the programs that are going to be challenged. Camden, Arkansas, again, more of a rural area, they're going to be doing about 90. Of course, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, about 80. Glens Falls, New York, 100. In those more populated areas, you might see higher numbers, and it might be a little easier to place. The challenging areas we find are, in the past, people who have difficulty are the more rural areas, lower industrialization, and if they have high numbers, like this Western Iowa, it can be a real challenge when it comes to placement time. Durham in North Carolina, they're expecting to place about 60 of them. The interesting thing, again, in as far as the curriculum goes, they all, almost most of them included wastewater this time, which, of course, last year no one talked about wastewater, and in our PLCs, we talked about the whole concept of water, wastewater coming into being, the fact that we've got a whole crop of 1970 people going into wastewater treatment plant operators in the 70s, and those people are all retiring now, and we see a large retirement. And we, in the past PLCs, have suggested that you may want to check in your community what the demand will be or how they're going to train those people, if they're going to do it internally or if they're going to be looking for someone for assistance to train those. And we did see most of the grantees going into this wastewater area as far as some sort of training. So I think during the year, and probably in Alexandria when we get together, we'll probably be talking about water, wastewater training and how that may enter into this whole program. Of course, we had underground storage tanks, and we had what was really interesting about the RFP this year is they were very specific about wanting you, making sure that you trained in these certain areas, and so that the grantees are all addressing these areas. And I think they're going to do exactly what EPA was hoping they would do, is they're going to look in the area at the needs assessment, and they're going to find out where the most jobs are, and they're going to train to those needs. But then they're also going to provide this general education in all of those areas that EPA is interested in, so that if some of those jobs come open in some of the more obscure, maybe less demand fields, that the students will be trained and ready to go into those jobs. We find that we also looked at how many of the grantees, who was the fiscal agent in these grantees? And it was interesting this year, I think. We had five that were cities. We had one county, only one community college and about eight community organizations. So I think the striking thing here that seems to be, if we call it a trend, or there seems to be more interest in cities and counties getting involved. And I think one of the early ones that did this was Durham. And of course, Winston-Salem, these were both North Carolina grantees, but there was an interesting partnership. And in the case of Durham, North Carolina, the city took this on, and they're working very close with the community college. So the face of the program is the community college, but the city is running it and coordinating it very closely with their employment and their brownfields and their economic development program. So by having the grant in the city office, it allows them to pull in a whole lot of these city resources, and even bringing in the WIBs and all of the governmental offices into this, and then bringing the community colleges in. It's interesting that there was only one community college, which was in Iowa, and they're going to have a little bit more of a challenge when you think about it, because they're going to have to go to the city and try to, in the case of a Durham or in the past in Winston-Salem, the city had the power to go out and go to the community college. In this case, the community college is now going to have to interact with the governmental agencies and try to bring them on board, which it's interesting. It could be a little more of a challenge for the community college to do this than it would be if it was going the other way. And then we have a whole lot of community groups, and some of those community groups are grassroots community groups like the Hunters Point family, which is truly a community group trying to get the people that live in that area employment and cleaning it up. And those of you that were on the PLC when Lena talked, Lena Miller told us about Hunters Point family and what was happening out there. Of course, it's very interesting. Hunters Point has been under development for 10 or 12 years. When we had a conference out there, we went to Hunters Point, and of course they were working on it then and cleaning it up. It's the issue of, are you going to gentrify the community and push? It's a community that started in the 1870s with military installations, and then through World War II, Hunters Point, they were building ships for the war, and it was a huge military base, a huge Superfund and brownfield site. And, of course, the community around it degraded, and so nobody wanted to live around there. The neighborhoods got run down and blighted, and when they closed the base, it got worse, and there were no jobs. And then they started cleaning it up, and here's a classic case where you're bringing in people from outside the community into Hunters Point to clean it up, not the community residents. And then you're cleaning it up, and now we've got some of the best real estate in the San Francisco area with beautiful vistas of the bay that the developers are salivating over in terms of development. And, in fact, in the Wall Street Journal last week, there was an article about China interested in investing with Lennar in developing Hunters Point. And, of course, the issue here is, well, what about all the people who have been victimized all these years? And so this is going to be a real interesting grantee to track and work with. And we're interested in, when they come to the grantees meeting, and talking to the people to Lena about how they're going to address this as it develops. So what I guess I'm getting at is, when we try to find some commonality amongst the grantees, even among regions, of course, Region 9 has the most. It's interesting, in the past, the northeastern regions had the most. There doesn't seem to be any commonality. There seems to be a real diversity in all of these grantees. And I don't know, I'm going to put Amber on the spot here in a second, but I don't know if this was planned or if it just happened. But it's interesting. I'm really excited about getting these grantees in a room And we're thinking of having a phone call with all the new grantees, but it's interesting that they do, they're very diverse. They're diverse in regions. We don't have any tribes this time, which usually there's one or two tribal grantees. But geographically, this is one of the most diverse awards that we've had, just about one from every region, with two from a couple of regions and three from region nine, four actually. But the types of training seem to be somewhat similar, but the number of people they're going to train, the community groups they're working with, there seems to be quite a diversity there. So Amber, what was your perspective on the grantee and the awards this round? Do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, actually, I think a lot of what you said is true. One thing that was just really, really evident was the strong partnerships, and I would say strong and diverse partnerships. We had some where they were really reaching out to nonprofits and other nearby cities and their councils of governments, you know, metropolitan organizations or metropolitan planning organizations, those types of partnerships to really expand the breadth of their program. And that really came through in the proposal. I think another area is the credentials and the certificates that will be earned. When those were very specific and they were explained in context with the type of training and employment that their graduates would be seeking, that was another thing that was very evident. When you can show that you tailored your proposal and what you're going to be tailoring your program to those types of needs in your community is key, which brings up one of the most important elements that we saw and continue to see is the labor market demand. The labor market today is very, very different than it was 5 years ago or even this time last year. So having a very current labor market demand and not just a lot of folks tend to just Google, you know, hazardous waste jobs in my area kind of thing, and put those statistics in, and that's not what's going to work. You need to really go out and talk to employers and figure out what their needs are and then design a curriculum to meet those needs. So having a really strong labor market demand was pretty important. And then I would say the last thing, and I want to bring it up really just because it's an opportunity to do so, we had an unfortunate number of threshold failures this year at the national level, not just in my region, but nationally. I want to say it's about 15%, somewhere in between 10 and 15% of all proposals failed. And I think almost all of those, with the exception of maybe one, was because each of the specified criteria, training program areas were not clearly discussed and shown to be presented as part of the curriculum. So I believe there were six that were required trainings. There's HazWhopper, and then there were five others. And what we didn't see, they may have in their threshold say, you know, yes, we're going to provide these, but then their attached curriculum did not show them as being provided as part of the curriculum. And we even had one proposal that said, well, yeah, we're doing HazWhopper, and these other five are going to be addressed in HazWhopper. And those of you that have been around job training know that the HazWhopper, 40-hour HazWhopper, is not intended to provide solid waste training and those integrated chemical management, those sorts of things are not included in basic HazWhopper. So there was a real disconnect between the training that the guidelines specified and that actually being reflected in the curriculum. And so hopefully we'll be able to fix that this year, because it's disappointing, because those could have been really great programs and maybe they just didn't clearly say it in their curriculum. So
how many, do you know how many programs, grant proposals were submitted?
I believe it was 76 nationally.
76. Mm-hmm. So 15 out of 76. That's not too bad.
I'd say 10 to 15%. So I want to say it was about 10 or 12 proposals nationally failed. But they failed maybe when they didn't need to, you know, and that's what makes it so disappointing.
When you say failed, are we talking about on the qualifying criteria, they didn't make the cut, or are you talking about they made the cut and they failed that test of all of the curriculum, which would make them fail the qualification.
Right, they failed that threshold criteria, so they never even went to the national ranking. And that's what's disappointing. These proposals take a lot of work to write, and these folks, you know, spent all that time writing it, but they just didn't clearly say that, so they never even made it to the national panel.
That is really interesting, and it's sad. Did you lose a lot of people who were just not qualified because they weren't the proper entity?
No, in fact, thankfully, I feel like that's a great thing. I don't think we had any that failed because they weren't an eligible entity, which is great. You know, that's really great. In fact, I think, there's the other issue of non-duplication, and I think we may have had one that had a duplication issue, but I think we got it resolved. I think they ended up passing. The main issue was truly that the specified training, the required training elements being brought into the curriculum.
And then, of course, I guess the thing that once you take out those 10 and then you're bringing it down to 65, then we have to get down to 15. Now we're talking about very specifically answering every question, and I guess that's where it came down to trying to sort these out, didn't it?
Right, and that's where I think the number one thing, in these national panels, the first question that's asked is, what's the likelihood these folks are going to get jobs? And, in this federal budget climate right now, we're really needing to demonstrate to Congress the effectiveness of our program. And so for us to be able to say, we're investing quite a bit of money into a job training program because we know these folks are going to be able to get jobs. Our program is happy to celebrate a 71% average placement rate nationally since the history of our program, and that's really exciting. And we're able to do that because we have these very comprehensive job training programs. So being able to demonstrate in a proposal, yes, these people will get jobs. And the way you do that is by making those strong partnerships, developing a labor market assessment, and then integrating that into your curriculum, and then engaging potential employers. And sometimes those potential employers are your nearby brownfield assessment, cleanup, and RLF grantees. Making sure those folks are engaged early on helps ensure that there's a higher likelihood that your graduates will be able to be sustaining and gainfully, if you will, employed. So I would say that was probably the biggest thing. And then there's some of the minor things where it seemed like maybe some of the curriculums or the proposed cycles just weren't well thought out. Maybe some of the math didn't add up. In one section they would say they're going to train, 10 people per cycle for 4 cycles, and then their attached milestones table would say they're going to do 5 cycles of 12 people each or something like that, where it just didn't really add up. Or, they focused a lot on their labor market assessment and said, gosh, we really need people that can do asbestos abatement, and then their curriculum didn't have asbestos abatement in it. So their curriculum didn't match their labor market assessment. Things like that just kind of didn't make sense, didn't really paint a clear picture. Those were really picked up by the national panel.
And those were just grant writing issues where they may have been had too many people writing different parts of the grant and not putting it together consistently.
Right, right.
Very interesting. Well, thanks for your insight. We'll let everyone know what's going on and what's happening. And one of the things we will do also is we're going to encourage everyone who submitted this year to work on the grants. And what we'll be doing in the fall, we'll be doing some coaching and seeing if we can get a better quality set of proposals in. Are you expecting a November RFP, or do you think they're going to get back on track as last year into the cycle?
I'm really hoping so. We just announced them this past week, so I'm really hoping that we can get back to kind of the cycle we used to be on, where they came out. The guidelines came out more in the September timeframe, October. But at this point, I don't know yet. Hopefully by October, by the grantees meeting, we'll have a better idea. Hopefully the RFP will be out.
Yeah. We encourage everyone, actually, who didn't make it this time to now is the time to start working on the new one and to get ready, and hopefully we'll get back on the track of this November before the end of the calendar year, getting awards, and so they can get back on track. I'm also really pleasantly surprised at how efficient EPA was this go around, that there were no 1 and 2 month delays. Once there was a delay in getting it out, but once it was out, the review process was extremely fast by past standards. So you all did a great job in that sense. We thought it wouldn't come out till we scheduled our grantee meeting in October, thinking that we're going to get the delay that these might not be awarded till August, but we were totally wrong on that. So thanks for the prompt action.
Well, thank you. And, you know, persistence is key, especially in the job training grant. So I strongly, strongly encourage anyone to stick with it, seek out you guys for help. You guys have been in this game a long time, and are having calls like this is a great way of reaching out to folks. And then call your regional coordinators and ask for your debrief of your proposal and start that process now. That's great advice.
And we do limit these to 30 minutes. So, I mean, this is the one last thing. Can we encourage or suggest that anyone who did not get an acceptance to call the regional rep to sit down with them? Or what is the feeling on that from EPA's perspective?
Absolutely. Please request a debrief. We can take the national panel comments and summarize them and go through them with you one-on-one. Absolutely. Please call your regional coordinator and set that up.
Okay. Do they have to do that in person, or can you send those to them? Or
Go ahead.
Do they need to? They do need to call you and then decide how to do that. Is that
sure? Right. Send an email to your or call your regional grant coordinator, and they'll set that up. Set aside a conference call time to do that with you.
But our goal is those who did not make it if they can call the regional rep and say, okay, what did I do wrong? And then so now we can start building on the next round, and then we could address, you know, those issues and go from there. Great. Well, thank you, Amber. Thank you, everyone. And we'll everyone listening to the call, and we'll send out post-session notes and talk to you all in a couple of weeks.
Great.
And
thank you.
Thanks again.
Thanks, everybody.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.